Let's read the Beatitudes. The Beatitudes. Matthew 5, verse 1. Now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. He said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way, they persecuted the prophets who were before you." We had a show of hands when I asked if anyone had heard this before. So you've heard this before. Well, if you're like me, I've heard this many times, and it kind of becomes normal, and you kind of look at it, and you're like, these are the words of Jesus, and you flip to the next page, and you keep going. Or you read through it, and you tick off the ones you think you're doing okay with. Anybody done that? You kind of like, oh, I'm a 50-50 here. You ever wonder why it's called the Beatitudes? You know, again, if you're like me, I think of the Beatitudes and I think of something comfortable and it's beautiful, right? I think of maybe the image that comes to my mind is a field with lots of beautiful flowers in it, and it's blue sky and it's a summer day. It's beautiful, the Beatitudes. Because of the word beatitude, it sounds like beautiful. But Beatitudes means something different. It means blessed. Blessed. What does blessed mean? I was thinking I could stand up here today and I could say, "Bless you in the name of the Lord." I could say, "Bless you." I could hear you sneeze and I could say, "Bless you." I could say, "May you be blessed today." What does the word blessing mean? Now, when we read verse 1 of chapter 5, we read that Jesus, he sees the crowds, he goes up on a mountainside, and he sat down. And I shared with you that I've put so much work and thought into this sermon, and I feel like there's so much that I cannot say. I can't talk to maybe what's the importance of Jesus being on the mountainside. But he's on a mountainside, and he begins to teach. And he teaches who? His disciples, people that have said Jesus is worth following. Now, the people that were gathered around listening to Jesus, they were like, you know, the guys from MNP. They were like, you know, the wealthy rulers of the day. No, they weren't. The people Jesus were talking to were common people like you and me. They weren't the prime ministers. They were common people. And the common people had a lot of problems in their lives. You know why they had a lot of problems in their lives? Well, for one, we heard from Caleb last week. They had a lot of problems because they were in a militarized zone. They had been conquered by the Romans. And life under the Romans wasn't that good. They had always thought they were God's chosen people. But now, Yahweh was no longer the one, I don't know, maybe taking care of them. It was the Romans that was ruling over them. Where was Yahweh? What was God doing? When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him, and he began to speak and taught them, saying. Now, you shouldn't think of the 12 disciples. You should think of not the crowds necessarily, but you should think of a couple hundred people listening to Jesus. And he says, "Blessed." Not because they sneezed either. He says, "Blessed." Now, hopefully we don't have any scholars in the room today. But when you think of the word blessed, it takes you back to the Hebrew Bible. And in the Hebrew Bible, there are 45 times that the word blessed is used to describe somebody. The word is asrei. One of those 45 times, it is about this king named Solomon. Solomon. Solomon surely was blessed. Solomon, he had a lot of money. He was the king. He was so wise that there was this queen named Queen Sheba who travels to meet King Solomon. And when she gets there, she is absolutely overwhelmed with what she sees. The king, he had made silver and gold so plentiful that it was as common as stones in Jerusalem. He had, of course, food and officials and servants. And she said, when she meets King Solomon, "The report I heard in my own country about your achievements and your wisdom is true. But I did not believe what they said until I came and saw with my own eyes. Indeed, not even the half of the greatness of your wisdom was told me. You have far exceeded the report. How happy your people must be. How asrei your people must be. How blessed your people must be. How happy your officials who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom." Blessed. That is the word being used in the Beatitudes, in the blessings. So this word blessing in the Beatitudes isn't me feeling sorry for you when you sneeze. It is a word that describes someone who is living the good life. Do you think King Solomon was living the good life? I think so too. Sounds pretty good to me. What is the good life? What is the good life? What does the good life in Thunder Bay look like? I mean, six-digit income, is that the good life? I mean, I heard Gary was ice fishing yesterday. Is that the good life? Yeah. I'm getting some no's and, it sounds pretty good to me. Did you catch anything? Oh, no. Not the good life. Not the good life. I don't know. Is the good life a summer camp on the lake? No? What? Is the good life someone that can escape to Florida and get away from this winter? Yeah. Yes, yes. What is the good life? Someone who loves you. Ah, I feel like you get along well with Jesus. You know, I was listening to a podcast, actually, and they actually asked that question to some different people. One guy's dream was to, you know, he's like, the good life would be to drive a bread truck all day. It always smells like fresh bread and listen to podcasts all day. You know, that's the good life. But if you really stop to think about it, sometimes without thinking, you know, we go around and we have these hopes or dreams of what the good life might be. I mean, you walk through a nice neighborhood and you think, it'd be kind of nice if, you know, we had that house or that car, or it'd be kind of nice if I had that job. And sometimes we don't always say that out loud, but like, there's always kind of this desire, isn't there, for something comfortable and nice. And I mean, it'd be nice to have a big pool in my backyard. You know, we kind of say these things and we don't intentionally say, well, that's the good life, because we're smarter than that. We're Christians. We're like, no, we know what the good life is. It's not that. But we do have desires for these comfortable things, don't we? When I asked my wife what the good life would be, she said to have a happy family. When I think about what the good life might be for me, I would think, imagine a day when I no longer had any inner insecurities or fears or anxieties. That would be a good life. So there's this desire for something better than what we currently have. And along comes Jesus and is using this word, blessed. Imagine Jesus walking not on the mountain anymore, walking down the road, and he's going along, and he sees somebody by the side of the road. The rabbis, they may be tall like this, and you look at this individual or the situation, and you say, Asrei is that situation. Blessed is that situation. That person there, they have the good life. It's like an object lesson. So let's hear the first object lesson. If you open up with me to Matthew 5, verse 3. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. See that person over there who has the poor spirit? They have the good life. But what does it mean to be poor in spirit? What I'm going to do as I go through these is tell you how I approach this, how I've read this most of my life. And then as I studied what some deeper meanings can be, or even how my meanings were very misguided. Poor in spirit. I mean, isn't that like the person that's like, oh, humble and pious and, I don't know, comes to the altar at the front of the church and they're like humble, they, you know, poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. You know what poor in spirit actually means? Again, you trace it back to the Hebrew Bible. It is the person that lacks everything, honestly. They're oppressed. Oh, much like the people Jesus is talking to in the Roman Empire. Much like them. Despised, distressed, they're miserable. They have what they would describe no life energy. Anybody relate to not feeling like you have any life energy? This isn't the pious person at the front of the church. This is the person that does not have life figured out, where life is caving in on them, the poor in spirit. They have the good life, says Jesus. See, that's why I encouraged us that when we come to the Beatitudes, something happens to us significant. I mean, does this not shock you a little bit? The good life? Really? How's that good? In Luke, there's a similar description of this passage. And I'm going to read it to you right now because it's such a contrast. So, blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you will be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you, when they exclude you and insult you and reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, because great is your reward in heaven, for that is how their ancestors treated the prophets. But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you will go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when everyone speaks well of you, for that is how their ancestors treated the false prophets. What do you do with Jesus' words? What do you do with these? These people's lives, poor in spirit, they are lacking in energy. They are just plain poor. They don't have life energy and they don't have money. Both those things. In the book of Job, remember the book of Job when Job is suffering a whole lot and he's struggling? Same idea for Job. His life, the energy is being sucked out of his life. This guy doesn't have enough energy to keep going. All right, number one, that's the good life. Let's move on to good life number two. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. You know, I've always read that as, you know, you come to that and you just think, I don't really know how, but somehow there must be some value in difficult things in life, in mourning and weeping, and then the promise is that we will be comforted. I was thinking, I know that a bunch of you have gone involved in our grief share program. Jesus is saying to you, the good life belongs to you. You're grieving. You will be comforted. You know, when you're poor and you have no money, and then on top of that, you have grief, isn't that difficult? Often, many of us, we have enough financial resources that we can kind of keep busy, we can kind of keep going, but the people Jesus is talking to, they don't have any money, and they have grief. When you're in that situation, you're kind of stuck, aren't you? There's not really anywhere for you to go. You have to sit with your grief and feel it. The good life belongs to you. You will be comforted. Good life, number three. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Oh yeah, Moses was the meekest man that ever lived. I mean, Moses was great, wasn't he? Meek, you know, again, kind of the humble idea, like, I mean, didn't think too much of themselves. No. That's not what meek means. That's not what this word means. Again, going back to the Old Testament and the way this word is used, the word is describing people who have wrong done to them. Wrong done to them. They're just unimportant. Their culture and their society doesn't really care about them. The word being used, I'll give you an example of Psalm 76. It is you alone who are to be feared, God. Who can stand before you when you are angry? From heaven you pronounce judgment, and the land feared and was quiet. When you, God, rose up to judge, to save all the afflicted. There's that word, meek. To save all the afflicted of the land. So it's the poor, the afflicted, the oppressed, the low status, the lacking in resources. How good is it for these people? For they're going to inherit the land. The people Jesus is talking to right now in chapter 5 are people who, what? They don't have their own land anymore. It's been taken from them by the Romans. You will inherit the land. Sounds like a promise from a long time ago. You will inherit the land. Not conquer the land. Inherit the land. What are we, at number four now, I think. Good life number four. We have five left, okay? Stick with me. When you're done, this is going to be a very, very good life, okay? Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. I've always read that as, you know, you just want to be near God. Hunger and thirst for righteousness. That's what this is about, wanting to be near God. Makes me think of Psalm 42 that says, as the deer pants for the water, so my soul longs for you, oh my God. You know that probably a much more logical way to look at even that psalm is that it's a wounded deer, a deer running for its life in exile. But another way to look at the hunger and thirsting for righteousness, righteousness isn't so much hungering and thirsting to be near God. It does include that. But even more so in this passage is righteousness is how you treat other people. Hunger and thirst for right relationships. Hunger and thirst to treat people right. So there's this sense in which you're hungering and thirsting for righteousness, for right relationships with each other, and you're hungering and thirsting for right relationship with God. Hungering and thirsting for right relationships. Because why? You will be satisfied. You will be satisfied. Okay, number five. Good life. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. You know, I think all of us are probably familiar with the word mercy. Mercy is something that you get when you don't deserve it. But this one takes it even farther, actually. Not just that we'll, like, with our friends or our fellow people that come to church with us, that we'll treat them with mercy when they don't deserve it. No. This is even more. This comes from the Hebrew word describing family love for each other. You know how you treat your family, or at least hopefully how you treat your family? You usually give them even more grace than you do the average person. Usually. You usually stand up for them a little bit more than the average person. That's how you treat. That's what mercy means here. It's a sense of love and loyalty and compassionate behavior. It is a deep love. It is the kind of love that is described through which God treats us. Mercy. Number six, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Again, when I read this, I often just think of someone kneeling right here, pure in heart. You're like desiring, you're going for God. You know what's the even deeper meaning here? That our external actions and our internal thoughts are matched. They're pure. Our internal thoughts and our external actions are matched. They're pure. How'd you do this week? Well, Jesus has a vision for us where he says, blessed are you when that's the case for you. For you will see God. You will see God. Really, every one of these nine Beatitudes could be a whole sermon in itself. So forgive me as I just jump to another one. Number seven, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are the peacemakers. I mean, I've read this many times, and I often think, yeah, like, I don't like conflict. I'm fine with that. I like the peace. I'll stay away. No. That's not what a peacemaker is. A peacemaker is the one that gets with people and helps broker peace between people. Is that a comfortable position to be in? Does that save you from anything difficult? Is that difficult? It is. It gets you in the midst of conflict. Blessed are the peacemakers. People that don't just withdraw, stick to myself, hopefully nobody says anything to me over here. God brokered or brought peace for us. God got into the mess and into the middle of messy, sinful humanity to bring peace. Christ was a peacemaker. So blessed are the peacemakers, or how good is life for the peacemakers, because they will be called children of God. This isn't the absence of conflict. It is the presence of harmony that you have to work for. And remember, again, the people Jesus is talking to are what? In the midst of Roman-occupied territory. We'll find out later in the Beatitudes, Jesus says, hey, listen, if a soldier asks you to walk 1 mile, go with them too. If a Roman soldier asks you to walk 1 mile, go with them too. Number eight. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. You know, honestly, in North America, the way that I've heard this used the most is something like, I tried to share the gospel today with someone, and the response I get, they just didn't like it. And they were offended. Well, I'm being persecuted for the name of Jesus. Well, you can tell I'm being a bit dramatic, and I think that there's a little bit of a problem with that. But oftentimes what I've heard it said is because that person didn't do a very good job sharing the message of Jesus. And so there was a reason that they were persecuted because of righteousness. But another way, a translation for this, is how good is life for those who have been persecuted on account of doing what is right. Remember that word righteousness we talked about earlier? How we treat each other? As we get into places of conflict, as we become peacemakers, do you think we're ever going to be misunderstood and persecuted on account of doing what's right? Do you think that we make the right decisions in the workplace and at home that we'll ever be blamed for or persecuted on account of doing what is right? Jesus, as he goes around sharing this message with people and healing people and helping them, you know who he has the most often confrontations with? It is the religious leaders of the day. You know the zealots of the day? They were this group all by themselves, and they wanted to fix the Roman occupation. They wanted to kill them. But Jesus says, no, He doesn't even get involved. As a matter of fact, he chooses one zealot to be, or one person maybe connected with these zealots to be one of his disciples. And he teaches this guy a whole different way of living. Well, another group, the Essenes, they thought, you know what? To like get the kingdom of God to come, we should go hide in the caves and we should study the law and we should just like do it all by ourselves. Jesus runs in with these guys all the time. And Jesus is persecuted. And the Pharisees dislike him so much because Jesus says things like, I came to fulfill the law. I am the fulfillment of the law. They hate him so much, they end up killing him. So Jesus is describing himself as well in this passage. And finally, the last one, blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. There's this sense in which in this life that Christ is calling us to live, we will face persecution. And it will be hard. And if you know the history of the church at all, as the church is launched after Jesus rises, these people gather in the name of Jesus, and you know what? They are actually killed for their faith. They are actually tortured and hung. And Jesus says, listen, people will say all kinds of evil against you. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. And it's almost like all of these nine things get us to a place where we're realizing like, man, something's coming. Heaven is coming. It's in the skies. Great is our reward. Where do we go from here? What kind of practical implications could this even have on our lives? Does it have any on our lives? And as I said, each verse could maybe be broken up into a whole sermon. But as I just pondered this and thought about this, there's one thing that I'm hoping that we leave with today. I'll read them through one more time in a different translation, so it just impacts us. How good is life for the poor in spirit, because theirs is the kingdom of the skies. How good is life for those who grieve, because they will be comforted. How good is life for the unimportant, because they will inherit the land. How good is life for those who hunger and thirst for right relationships, because they will be satisfied. How good is life for those who show mercy, because they will be shown mercy. How good is life for the pure in heart, because they will see God. How good is life for the peacemakers, because they will be called children of God. How good is life for those who have been persecuted on account of doing what is right, because theirs is the kingdom of the skies. How good is life for you when they insult you and persecute you and speak evil lies against you on account of me. Celebrate and shout for joy, because your reward, it is great in the skies, because this is how they persecuted the prophets before you. Is that not shocking? The good life? The good life. As we even go further into the Beatitudes or into the Sermon on the Mount, we're going to see this shocking kingdom that Jesus is telling us about. It only grows. It only becomes a bigger shock. I was thinking about us and how this could maybe apply to us and myself. I was thinking how it reminds me of a story that I read about some Christians in Eritrea. Eritrea is a place where it's dangerous to be a Christian. And sometimes Christians are arrested and they are put in prison. And one of the ways in which they treat these Christians in Eritrea is they put them in a shipping container and close the door. And there's no window in it. There's no light at all. One person, I think, spent a year inside there. Doesn't that sound a lot like the last verse of the Beatitudes? Blessed are you when you are persecuted. But you know what this person said when they finally came out of that place a year later? They said something like, that place was the closest place I ever was to Jesus. It makes me think of people in our society that our society looks down on. Makes me think of my wife and how we've many times over the years been out on the streets on Friday night. And my wife always says to me, I never see Jesus more clearly than when I'm on the streets. It makes me think of people like you and I. It makes me think of Anton and Sagaya right up here who shared their testimony with us a month or so ago. And they shared how life in their country of Sri Lanka was so very difficult and things were falling apart. And yet, they shared how God has been faithful to them and brought them here and how they feel blessed. But there's pain there. I think of my father-in-law over the last couple years fighting against cancer. I read these Beatitudes and I think of us. I think of my wife longing for a happy family. Is that not hungering and thirsting for right relationships? The element in which, you know, to hunger and thirst means you're never quite satisfied. Hunger and thirst for right relationships. I think of Pastor Gene and Terry's son who's been in a coma for years. I think of us when I read these Beatitudes. The good life belongs to you. It reminds me of Jesus. Jesus, he's vulnerable when he comes to this earth. As a matter of fact, he says, the foxes have holes and the birds have nests, but the Son of Man, he has nowhere to lay his head. He makes himself powerless on our behalf. He goes to the Garden of Gethsemane weeping. Jesus weeping? Jesus brought life and healing to everybody that he met. Did he not? But here's Jesus emptying himself of everything that he has. And it's there in the garden and on the cross at the crucifixion that the greatest glory of God is displayed. We often think that our pain, because honestly, when you read the Beatitudes, how comfortable are any of those? None of them. None. We often think that our pain and our suffering, if it was removed, it would really help. But there's a psychologist named Hayes, and he disagreed. He said he thinks that suffering and pain, we often think they're to be avoided and buffered whenever possible. But he saw it as an inevitable and essential part of being human, as well as a source of fulfillment when we do not flee from what scares us. Often it's out of the greatest woundedness in our life through which our gifting to help other people comes. And Jesus set us that very example. And so maybe what I'm pondering and wondering about as I read the Beatitudes is could it be that in these places that we find ourselves, in this pain, in this unansweredness, and yet this hope that something good is coming, you will be comforted, that it's in those places that it opens us up to God? Because the good life belongs to you, says Jesus. Blessed are you. I'm thinking maybe it strips away something that makes us otherwise fairly self-sufficient people. I was thinking of a few weeks ago, I came in really early to the church on Sunday morning. I had had a difficult week. I was here at 3:30 in the morning, and I felt like I had nothing inside of me. Nothing. I felt like all those fears and insecurities that I mentioned that I would just like removed, I felt like they were the loudest voices in my mind that morning. You know, as I got on my knees, and in those moments of lack, deep lack, I found myself weeping here by myself. And I'm thinking that many of us might find ourselves in similar situations. When we feel as if those painful things, those hard things, those empty things, those grieving things, they should be removed. But then I'm wondering if maybe at the 3:30s in the morning, if it's there with all those things happening that are negative or those thoughts or those, you can place your finger on what that thing is. I'm wondering if it's there that we are most often and most graciously met by God. And I'm wondering if without those things, if we might forget, might move away from who God is. The good life belongs to you. There's an image that comes to mind, and I'll call the worship team up at this time, but there's a picture that I have up here, or I aim to have up here, and can you see that okay? That is Charles Blondin. Charles Blondin was a tightrope walker, and Charles Blondin decided one day to tightrope across Niagara Falls. Now, he did do it below the falls, so, I mean, maybe that was a bit safer. But his rope was 1,000 feet long, 1,000 feet to walk across. The rope was 3 inches around, and only 160 feet above the water. I mean, if you're fine. If you fall 160 feet into water, you're good. No, you're not. Not only does he walk across the rope, but he carries his manager, Harry, on his back across the rope. And that's the image that came to mind when I thought about the Sermon on the Mount, or actually the Beatitudes here. There's this image in which does not the struggle, the weeping, when we're persecuted, does it not open us up to who God is? And is not the image one where we cling on to Jesus? We cling on and we walk that tightrope? Now Jesus, he's safe. He's a good one to be walking across a tightrope with. Now Jesus, he was surely raised again from the dead, wasn't he? And just as surely as Jesus was raised again from the dead, you will be comforted. The kingdom of heaven will be yours. You will inherit the land. You will be satisfied. You will see God. You will be called children of God. Because yours is the kingdom of the skies. Let's pray.